Plenty going on Radio 1 through the day. This is Playback Daily. I'm Carol Moran, and here's what you might have missed.
I don't think I was ever hindered in the opportunities that I was given as a female. I think in many ways, which is potentially controversial view, I think it helped some aspects. When I spoke on the pit wall on the radio as a Northern Irish female, like, my voice stood out.
You are at 7'6". 7 foot six, Sean. Would you be Ireland's tallest man, insofar as you know?
As far as I'm aware, yes. I'm Ireland's tallest man still.
Choosing a career at 17 and deciding you're going to stay in it for the rest of your life is like making the decision that you're going to buy a pair of jeans today and wear them for the rest of your life. You just wear the same thing for the rest of your life. Nobody would expect you to do that.
And we'll start in the afternoon. After Shane's call to Joe during the week, the issues surrounding conditions like Marfan syndrome and gigantism came up again on the live line when Ireland's tallest man, Sean Aspett, called Joe.
Now, Sean Aspett has the title. I don't even know if it sits easily on your shoulders, Sean, because of what you've been through. You are at 7 foot 6. 7 foot That's six, right. Sean. Would you be Ireland's tallest man, insofar as you know?
As far as I'm aware, yes. I'm Ireland's tallest man still.
Okay. And is it a condition that brings you to 7 foot six?
Yes, I have gigantism.
Okay.
Basically, it causes you to keep growing, more or less.
And when did you realise this, or your family realise it?
Well, basically, I was about 6'5" by the time I was 14,
okay,
in school, and as I say, basically towering over the other teachers and things like that. Went to a doctor, and he didn't diagnose gigantism at that stage, but basically he told me I would keep growing and probably wouldn't see the age of 40.
Why? Why would you not see the age of 40? Sorry, not why you...
He basically said that it would be such a strain on your body.
Okay.
So I basically went, as I say, lived the wildlife like an idiot. Left school, went, worked, got jobs in bars. And because I was, as I say, 6'5" or so, they thought I was 16, 17. Did the whole bar apprenticeship, worked in security, all kinds of things like that.
But were you, Sean, were you a big baby?
Yeah. Well, I was born basically, goodness me, it was one of those record weights. I also had 5 teeth and full head of hair.
Wow.
And one of the problems, like I heard Ava had there, was basically when my mother would bring me along to the playground as a baby in the farm and things like that, and she'd put me in the sandbox to play, yeah, and then other mothers would suddenly take their kids away, thinking that this was some sort of mentally disturbed kid because I was much, much, much bigger for my age, you know?
And being born, Sean, being born with 5 teeth, I'm not being facetious, but you wouldn't have known what to do with them, surely, or what?
No, I basically, as babies do, they put their hands in their mouths. Of course, I was biting my fingers and doing all kind of things, so they had to put boxing gloves on me.
Seriously?
Yep, and I eat through them.
Okay, and you say it hasn't been an easy road. When did it overwhelm you? By the way, were you picked on in school?
Oh, yeah, lots of the time, basically. One of the problems as well was shoe sizes and things like that. So when we did gym, I'd have to do it in my bare feet or in socks playing against other lads, and they'd sort of stamp on my feet, making it very hard for me to play things like basketball or football.
Even though you would have had the height for the basketball.
Yeah. Myself and another chap were tall in the class, and he also said the same thing to me. He says, interesting, isn't it, how we were pretty much perfect for the height to be able to play basketball, and yet we were the last to be picked every time.
Okay. And by the way, what size shoes do you take now?
I take a size 22, basically. At that time, I was taking about 14, but you couldn't get 14s in Dublin even then.
And where do you get size 22?
The place in Atlanta, Georgia, there's a shop there called Myers. They make a size 22. And they're about the only ones that do sell them commercially. Sometimes total fluke. You'll see them on some other website as well, like a pair of runners or something that augments. But in Dublin, believe it or not, just about 4 months ago, I was in TK Maxx. I pop in there regularly because they sometimes have augments. This is the one in the Stevens Green Centre, and they had two pairs of size 22 deck shoes.
No.
And I got them, and they were €14 each. I couldn't believe my luck.
TK Maxx.
A blessing.
TK Maxx, were selling size 22 shoes.
Yep, there was basically two pairs there, and I grabbed them immediately.
You grabbed them, yeah, and ran. And Sean, where were they manufactured?
Lord only knows. As I say, I haven't found the manufacturing thing on them yet because I've been looking around and trying to trace down names and bits of things. I don't want to tear them apart.
Yeah, of course. Don't.
It was the third time I'd actually got shoes there. So, like, I got a pair of runners there before one day. And so that's the reason I pop in there. And I've asked them if they do get them to, you know, give me a buzz. But, I mean, staff change over in these places pretty quickly.
Of course,
But yeah, it's a place where they get the augments, and as I say, I've been lucky there, or blessed.
And Joe asked Sean about the impact his size has had on his life.
When did it go wrong in terms of it have had an impact on your life? Because what age were you when things got out of control, so to speak?
Well, as I say, throughout my life, basically, there always was that kind of things. As I say, not being able to get on the swings as a kid and go down the slide or playgrounds and things like that because, you know, you were too big. To kids picking on you in school, wanting to fight all the time, and the teachers would suddenly, you know, come into the fight and see you there, and immediately you were the one who started.
Of course,
you know,
you
were the big one who stuck out, like, yeah.
And were you picked?
Were you accused of bullying?
Were you picked out on because of your size?
Well, I mean, kids are always like that. Anything different, and they'll turn around and call you names and want to cause fights and things like that. So I had that a lot, as I say. Most of the time I tried to walk away and just, you know, go away and do something else with your life, kind of thing. And I still do that today, as I say.
And then things began to go haywire, in your later teen years, is it?
Well, I grew to 6'11" and I stopped around 21.
Okay.
And then basically at the age of about 39, I started to grow again.
Wow.
And that's had an impact on my life, unfortunately, now, in that it's caused my legs to lose power and feeling and things like that. So I've unfortunately ended up now in a wheelchair since 2003.
Oh, sorry to hear that.
But,
And why are you in a wheelchair specifically? Is it the legs that have...
Legs can't take it. I also have a syndrome called Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, which is a bit like Marfan. It's with the connective tissue but in the bones and things like that. I'd be trying to go around on crutches and they'd be just tearing at my shoulders to be pushing myself around the place on crutches, things like that, you know.
And when you were mobile, could you cycle a bike?
I lived in Belgium for a while. I was pastoring a church over there and I got a lovely bike from Holland. Perfectly made for me. And when I brought it back to Ireland, I was working in Dell there in Bray, and I'd be cycling back. And because of the height and the height of the bike, I'd be actually looking into the people on the top deck of the bus, if you know what I mean. And so kids would see and throw rocks at you because you're different, you know what I mean? But so I gave up the old cycling there. And, well, I mean, it's also because of problems with the legs as well anyway.
And how's your health now? I know you're in your early 60s.
Yeah. Our health's okay. There's some heart things which you need to keep an eye on as well. I've got an aneurysm there in the aorta. Basically, as I say, the legs are dead, but I can still move right leg a little bit, like, you know what I mean? Just enough to transfer from the wheelchair onto the bed or to the toilet or things like that. Buses are much better now because they have these panels that come out and, you know, you can roll up to your wheelchair. And go into a different place. Now, the place they have there is very tight because there's a bar there and you have to yourself go into the people on the opposite side and they have to move their legs while you squeeze around because, as I say, mm-hmm. they probably measure them for the normal people and the smaller yeah. people. And as I say, the big people like myself, my feet stick out a mile now, as I say, so...
Well, that's Sean there. Then Ron called about his daughter's condition, Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, EDS.
My daughter has Ehlers-Danlos syndrome.
Okay.
Now, Ehlers-Danlos syndrome is genetic.
Okay.
And she inherited it from me. I inherited it through my mother. The main point, Joe, that I'd like to bring up about EDS or Ehlers-Danlos syndrome yeah. is that... My daughter was diagnosed as an adult. It really came on her as an adult.
Okay.
She was double jointed as a child. Not over tall, 5'11".
Mm-hmm.
But in hypermobile syndrome or EDS is a progressive disease. And my daughter was constantly going in and out of hospital with severe pains in her joints, in her neck, everywhere. Mm. And it was put down as being psychosomatic.
Okay.
And that would be the experience of many people who have went to hospital with EDS in this country.
Okay.
If you have an MRI scan lying down, it doesn't show EDS. You have to have an upright scan.
Wow.
They haven't got it in this country, so my daughter had to travel to England. And then there was a possibility that she was going to have surgery.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody here... really done it. One very major surgeon said that he would do it, and my daughter refused it because he had never done it before. So obviously she was nervous about yeah. it, and it's major surgery. She travelled to Spain, or told 78,000 in Spain to have it done, and she found another man in England, 30-something thousand sterling, so 40,000 Irish. But the thing about it is
mm-hmm.
that in this country, because it's progressive, there's possibly only about two people in the country who can definitively diagnose Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, or EDS. And we brought our daughter to Cork
mm-hmm.
to a man there. I cannot think of his name now because it's a good few years ago. And he practices in the matter in Cork and the okay. matter private. So we brought our daughter to him privately because it's progressive. We couldn't wait. And because we went private, mm-hmm. that means that the Irish state will not support anybody who has to travel with this illness to anywhere outside of Ireland. So that's my crow to pick with.
Okay, and I'll come back to that in a sec. But Ron, did you say you have it as well?
I have it. It was handed to me through my mother. For instance, my mother had a lot of miscarriages, which is one of the main thing that happened with women. Of course, going back in my mother's time, I hadn't even got a clue mm-hmm. about what it was. And she eventually was taken in for TB. And when she was brought in, it was found that she was pregnant with me. And because she was on her back in the hospital for all those months, she managed to carry me. And
my mother, for instance,
was double yeah. jointed, which is another sign of the illness.
Yeah.
My daughter's double jointed.
And when did you realise you had it, Ron?
I only realised it when my daughter eventually went for gene tests here in Ireland in the Children's Hospital. Now, the reason she had to do that was because she needed a disability payment. And it's only about 3 to 4 years that EDS has been accepted as a disability in this country. So I went and they told me, now, I've never had any problems with it. The only thing was when I was a young man, I got an interest in yoga and nobody taught me I could do all the positions.
Because of your joint mobility.
Because of my joint mobility.
Well, that's Ron there. Then Anne-Marie called Jo. She was diagnosed with a form of gigantism in her 40s.
I was diagnosed with acromegaly in 2007, officially.
Okay.
Acromegaly is the adult form of the giantism.
Okay.
It's basically everyone produces growth hormone
right.
from the time they're born. And if you have excess growth hormone from the time you're born up until normal cessation of your growth, it's giantism. After that, it would be the adult form of it, which is acromegaly. But you can't grow taller because your bones are fused to the top of your head, so you can't go upwards, only a fraction, but you grow everywhere else the same as giantism. The same implications, but it's strange because I actually am just 4'10".
Okay.
When I was small, I wasn't growing a lot, so I was checked up on that, but they didn't find anything particularly. Mm-hmm. But I reached just the short side of normal height, around 5 foot, just okay. under 5 foot.
And when you say, okay, so, you stopped growing upwards. And how does it then affect the rest of your body?
Well, your hands, your feet, your head, your muscles, all your internal organs, everywhere. And your teeth are all, your jawbones all move, your bones all move.
Oh, God.
So it has implications like for you for the rest of your life.
And tough implications.
Sorry?
Difficult implications, tough implications.
Yeah. Well, if your heart grows, like you're putting pressure on your heart, your organs, any growths, like cancerous growths, anything, you could get tags on your skin. Well, as I said, your hands, your nails, your hair, they would go quickly. With the tumour, it's caused, there's normally a tumour on the pituitary gland,
okay.
which produces excess growth.
Right.
It's one of the seven tumours that you could find on the pituitary gland. But as the tumour's growing then, it can press the optic nerves and you could lose your eyesight, but it causes other massive problems. And some people are suitable for it to be removed surgically. Others have to get radiation, but some even after surgery need radiation, things like that. So they can be damaged then once you've had a tumour removed, but all your sinuses are all affected as well.
Okay.
Yeah.
And the way they do the surgery, transsphenoidal, like they can go in under the roof of the mouth up and in to where the pituitary gland is. So that can affect all your sinuses. Your bone structure in your sinuses is all changed. Affects your sleep, your heart, your muscles. Your muscles are normally weak with it as well. And it can affect memory, it can affect eyesight, vision, your appetite, everything and anything.
And is there any treatment, Anne-Marie?
Is there any?
Treatment
first. Yeah, the treatment is, the first thing is they check how everything is and then they make a decision what's the best. A lot of people would have it removed. Some transsphenoidally, as I said, through the roof of the mouth and up and into the pituitary gland. Others would go through the head, cranioplasty, I think it's called. And following that, then you'd be monitored, and then you might be given an injection once a month to control the growth hormone. Other times, then you might have radiation. It depends, basically, on how the tumour was presenting.
Yeah.
How big it was and where it was wrapped around.
And when you say it's not, it doesn't happen until you're an adult, what stage were you at when it was diagnosed, Anne-Marie?
In my mid-40s.
Anne-Marie on the Liveline with Joe Duffy. And on Today with Claire Byrne, the reset after COVID. Sinead Brady was telling Claire about her new book, Work to Live, How to Navigate Your Career to Get the Best Out of Your Life.
A teacher, an astronaut, a dancer, a doctor. Children talk so often, don't they, about what they might want to be when they grow up. But when we get to that point in our lives, are we really prepared for the world of work? Well, this is something that career and work psychologist Sinead Brady has been writing about in her new book, Total Reset, Quit Living to work and start working to live. And Sinead is here now. You're very welcome, Sinead.
Thanks, Claire.
Congratulations on the book.
Thank you very much.
It's very topical.
It is.
Very topical because
yes.
Everybody had a bit of a reset, didn't they?
They did.
During the pandemic. Now people are falling back into the old ways and getting on with it. But you talk about this age-old concept that our work and our careers are the most important, all-encompassing aspect of our lives, should take precedence over all else. And that's linked really to that concept now that we should all be always on. And there has definitely been a shift in that, would you agree?
100% agree. And the shift is for the better, Claire, because we're not an operating system. We're not a MacBook or a tablet or anything like that. We're not made to be on all of the time. Our body actually needs to switch off to recover, to recuperate in order to be able to function in any way. And your brain and your body are completely linked to one another, and we must be able to switch off. So this notion of having to be constantly on in the 24/7 hustle is just something that we, in our paid and unpaid lives.
But aren't we told, though, from junior infants all the way up, that if you want to be successful, you've got to work hard, whether it's at your dancing competition or your reading or your work?
100%. And our education system fuels and feeds our workplaces. And we have the most phenomenal educators, and my own children's school is an example of that. But every school, the curriculum is designed that children go in, sit down all day, every day in the one place, in the one space. And then at the end of the day, they come home, quickly eat something, and then start to do homework. And we're not actually teaching our children from the youngest of ages that it is important to switch off. We don't teach. And sadly, we have to teach people how to relax. And we're not teaching that to people. I mean, when my little girl, Cyrilla, was about to go to school, she went in for that taster day.
Yeah.
And she said to me when she came back out, she said, "Mommy, that was lovely." And I said, "Oh yeah, well, you're going to be there from September." And she said, "Oh, I don't think I'll bother." And I said, "Right." And she goes, "I don't want to sit in the same place all day, and I don't want to wear the same clothes every day."
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, it's hard to argue with.
Yeah.
So it's a bit like, you know, she kind of in her own little way sensed it. But it's just the way our education system is set up to map into the world of work.
And is that what younger people in particular are saying about careers now? I don't want to sit at that desk for the rest of my career, and I don't want to fit into that space for the next 40 years.
Absolutely. And I mean, there's an example of it in the book of a young guy who was kind of had achieved all of the milestones, had done really well in school, was heading off into the internship, had got the graduate programme, and he kind of was heading off home one Friday evening, and his kind of more senior, let's call him his boss, walked out after him, was accompanying him. He goes, "I've just noticed now, this is your second Friday to head home at 5 o'clock. He said, "You know, there's drinks and we kind of tend to work on, and we come in on Saturdays as well, and you have them here, and these things are noticed." And he was like, "Oh, okay." And then he handed in his notice the following Friday, and he said, "Like, that's not the future I want. This is a great place to work. Yes, you have great opportunities, but that's not the life that I want at 40 or 45. And he just made the decision at that early point.
That takes a lot of confidence to do that.
I think it does. But the narrative is shifting around that in the wider community, I think, Claire. I mean, the notion of the ideal worker, where you start work and you stay in that job for the remainder of your career and everything else takes second place to your work.
Mm-hmm.
People are stepping away from that. And in fact, that sociocultural narrative denies many women the opportunity to return to the workplace if they've been out of the paid workplace for caring or rearing reasons. And it also denies many men who are fathers the opportunity to spend time with their children. And in fact, they are kind of almost programmed to intensify their work during those years. So there's lots of shifts that are happening that help everybody. And yes, young people are saying, "You know what? I want something different. I don't want to spend 70 hours per week in a job. I want to be able to live life and to work."
So you want to try with the Total Reset to give people the tools to understand careers and how they should work. Is that it? The basic concepts?
Absolutely. And we're not taught those. You know, we're all, as you said, from the very youngest age, we're asked, "What do you want to be when you grow up?" And then suddenly you find yourself grown up and you're not sure what you want to be. And you haven't been given this very basic skills of like, what's a job? What's the difference between a job and a career? How do I navigate when I decide that I want to change my job or change my career? How do I go about that?
And Claire asked Sinead about knowing your options.
You know, I'm thinking about Bernie Collins, who we spoke to a little earlier, who's involved in Formula One at a very senior level and is now going on to front the Sky Sports coverage. Just such an exciting career ahead of her and behind her. But she was saying that she was always interested in maths and physics, but nobody really said to her, you could have a career in engineering and Formula One. You know, that she felt she couldn't see the options when she was in secondary school and university. The horizon wasn't there for her.
Yeah, and that's the thing. The options are changing every day. So as you begin to mature in your career, you begin to evaluate and self-evaluate. So I would always say to people, you know, organize yourself and think about momentous moments. They're the big things that you're achieving on an ongoing basis. And keep a document open on your desktop, call it momentous moments. And as you go through your career, just add to it and begin to put the big things that are happening in there. Right. And then you can begin to see maybe a pattern developing.
Now, some listener feedback here. Can your speaker help? That's Sinead. My husband is in his mid-50s. He's so unhappy in his job, but due to financial reasons, he can't leave. She'd love to speak to someone to find out what he should do, but they're just not sure where to go from here.
Yeah, so there's a couple of different things. It's really hard when you've, you know, financially restricted within a job that you're not necessarily, or a career that you're not necessarily enjoying. So what I would say in the first instance is there's a couple of small things that you can do. Begin to break your job down into the function of your job. So your function describes the technical thing that you do, that thing that you go in and you know you're going to do every single day. So look at the function of your job and say, okay, so is it the technical aspect of what I do, the function of what I do that I enjoy or I don't enjoy? And then separate that out and go, is it the environment that I'm doing it in? And that's kind of your colleagues, your team, the organization that you're within, the wider industry that you're working in. Mm-hmm. And begin to think, okay, so maybe it's colleagues, maybe somebody in management has changed recently.
So if I was doing the same function in another organisation, how would I feel?
Correct. And then if you look at it and go, well, actually, it's the function, but I like my organisation, then begin to look to see if there's upskilling, reskilling or retraining opportunities, because organisations are trying to retain people at the moment and they're willing to help retrain them or to help you to do something part-time if you so wish. Mm-hmm. If it's both function and environment, that's a different story. But there are things that you can do very practically. Job crafting is an option. So it's looking for what you do that you really enjoy within your role and then playing to your skills and trying to integrate more of that into your job on a daily basis. And if you're in a position to delegate some of the things that you don't enjoy as much.
Sinead Brady, work psychologist from Today with Claire Byrne. And in the morning, local produce and seasonal eating. Brendan Courtney was talking to Michelin star chef JP McMahon about his latest book, An Alphabet of Anir, Notes for New Irish Cuisine.
Congratulations on the book. Now, before we dive into the book, which I spent a good evening with last night, it's a great little dip in and dip out. So congratulations. Tell people who may not know about Anir, about the restaurant, please.
So Anir is 12 years old this year, and it began as a project to see what type of restaurant you could do if you limited yourself to the ingredients that that exist in Ireland. I suppose that's what it is in a nutshell.
Wonderful. And the book reflects that, the book that's come out now, which is your second book.
Yeah, very much so. I wrote a bigger book, the Irish Cookbook, which dealt with like the entire history of Irish food over 10,000 years with 500 recipes. But this one is more of a, as I said, a reading book. There's a few recipes, but there is a disclaimer on the website that, so this is not a recipe book.
Okay.
I use the form of the alphabet to talk about all the different things that we do in the restaurant, like foraging or using seaweed or wild game or many, many different things about Irish food history that people may not know. Because when you ask someone about what is Irish cuisine, it is a difficult question because of the legacy of the famine and colonialism.
Of course. And I until I picked up your book, I hadn't heard the phrase Irish cuisine. So it's wonderful that you're owning that as well. Just to say as well, Anir, you also run a boutique cookery school, correct?
I do, and we do 6 to 8 people usually one Sunday a month, and then we run a 6-week class on Monday nights. And that started at the very beginning of the restaurant to try and we weren't so busy because we were doing adventurous things like not using lemons or black pepper or all those things, and people were serving steaks and people were a bit wary of us. So we set up a little cooking school, and thankfully the restaurant is going well, and as you say, it retained its Michelin star this year. But we set up a cookery school that has also just it's to educate people not only about Irish food but about cooking in general
and about what you do, because that is quite a fascinating thing, to limit yourself not to use lemon or black pepper in cooking. And I like that cooking is, I know as much about cooking as I do about football, so you're going to lead me on this. But were you, was it a good idea to not use lemon and black pepper, and how did that work for you? Was it awkward?
Like, it was very difficult to begin with, and it's not something like I limit myself at home, so it's not like I'm some sort of crazy purist that I say these things cannot be used. It's more about, like, we wanted to see what would happen, and we were very influenced. I'm sure many listeners know the restaurant Noma in Copenhagen, and they about 2005 began this type of thinking, that saying what would happen if we limited ourselves. And what it does is it makes you more creative, because if you have to find, like, lemon gives acidity, which is a really, really important component in building a dish, so you have to find other types of acidity. And then you go look at different vinegars, like cider vinegar, and then you start making vinegars, and we make a seaweed vinegar for our oyster dish now. And like, it did take a while. I mean, ironically, black pepper you can live without. It has nothing to do with salt. Many people confuse salt and pepper because the French put them together, but salt is essential for living. Pepper is not.
That's very interesting. What I'm kind of getting, and maybe correct me if I'm wrong, is that in a way is if you were landlocked on an island and you can only access the natural goods that are near you, this is the kind of cooking you're thinking about. Is that correct?
Yeah, 100%. And I'm very interested in Irish history. And if you go back pre-potato, so about 1600, like, there was a lot of oats, buttermilk, wild food, wild game, seaweed, shellfish, all of these things. And we have all these things. And I suppose we just, perhaps don't appreciate them as much because we live in a global world. So the restaurant is like a little oasis to kind of step outside time and just to go in and say, oh, this is interesting. We have an oyster dish with seaweed. And to taste it. And sometimes I'm interested in trying to capture tastes that we might have forgotten, because when we're so used to seasoning in a contemporary way, you can put some spice on it, you can put, like, you can go in your own house, you can make a Mexican dish, even though we're thousands of miles from Mexico. And it's just a little reprieve from that to think about what would happen if there was no other, we had no access to stuff from around the world.
And Brendan asked JP about his policy on the potato.
This is a quote from you. We didn't serve potatoes and there was nearly a riot. Tell me about that.
At the beginning, we have a tasting menu now, but at the beginning we just did a la carte and we said, look, we're not going to serve potatoes on the side. And there was literally, people were like, where are the spuds? And we were like, oh, you don't need them. And they were like, we do need them. And what we found over 2 years was that people were using the spuds as a safety net, like the spuds that you get in the middle. And we just end up throwing out so many of them. So we went cold turkey, I remember one Christmas, and we said, We're done. And we forgot to tell, my brother Alex was managing at the time, and we forgot to tell him. And so he went, opened the hot drawer and went, where are the potatoes? And we said, oh, we didn't do any tonight. And he was like, the customers are looking for potatoes. And I said, you're going to have to tell them we're done. And we do have potato dishes on occasion, but we are, as an island, addicted to potatoes. But what's interesting is we're a net importer of potatoes now. And so we don't grow as many potatoes as we used to. And a lot of people see them as kind of central to Irish cuisine. But I mean, I think they're a kind of peripheral new ingredient. If you think about, people have been in Ireland 10,000 years and the potato's been here 400. So they are a relatively new ingredient.
So if you have, you know, visitors to the area, sort of people might go to restaurants, they could be looking for steak and spuds and those kind of things, right? Do you ever feel the pressure to give them what they want, or do you?
Yeah, occasionally. And sometimes when we get a really nice piece of beef, we do use Dexter beef on occasion. And it's a native cow that is a lot smaller.
Yeah.
And we usually serve it as tartare, but sometimes we do put it like a steak on, but it wouldn't be like your steak and chips if you were coming in looking for it. But I think that by and large now, and actually we were closed over the pandemic, but the pandemic actually helped us to a certain degree, in the sense that pre-pandemic, most of our customers were American. We would do 80% American tourists.
Wow.
Looking for a kind of new Irish cuisine. And during the summer of the staycation, we had so many people from all around Ireland come to an ear because they couldn't travel, and they all thought we were new, and we were there 10 years and they were saying, oh, this is really interesting, are you new? And so I'm still really always surprised when people come into the restaurant, particularly local people, and say, oh, I've never been in here before, and I'm going, well, that's wonderful, because it's just a little like a little chamber to think about what food would look like. Now, there are two ingredients, because someone will ring you and say, we don't produce sugar in Ireland anymore, and that is absolutely correct, and okay, we don't produce white flour. So there are two exceptions we make,
right?
Just because as you can run a restaurant without black pepper and potatoes, but you cannot run a restaurant without sugar. It's very difficult, particularly when you get to the desserts.
We were talking about the deer in the park earlier, where I spend a lot of time up in the Phoenix Park, and I presume you serve Irish venison. Is it wild or farmed?
It's wild. There's actually, to my knowledge, there is only one venison farm, and it's up in Northern Ireland. We would get our venison from County Clare, and some people like the deers and they're cute, but like, we serve rabbit as well, and that's like, we don't eat enough rabbit in Ireland. There are literally tens of thousands of rabbits all over the country.
Okay.
And we're all eating chicken every day because chickens aren't cute, and and that's the difficulty. Like, we put little human features on these animals, but like, eating rabbit and venison is really sustainable, because deer breed so rapidly. Like, a couple of hundred deer can turn into thousands in a number of years, and so the deer are culled very carefully, and Eamon Gibbon, our hunter, supplies us with venison and also pigeon, pheasant, partridge, and I didn't grow up with these game birds. I grew up in Maynooth, like, eating Rice Krispies and Cocoa Pops, and it wasn't until I became a chef that I realised we have this long heritage. Like, the wild duck has been in Ireland 10,000 years, so it's like, if you want to think about what people were eating 10,000 years ago, like, oysters and wild duck would be a good place to start.
And Brendan wondered if customers are more open-minded about food and the 22 course tasting menu.
We've got to the point now where we just do a very long tasting menu. We do a 22 course tasting menu. Now, some of the courses are very small, so
that's
like, don't fall over. It takes
22 courses.
It takes about 3 hours, but some of them are really small. Like, we just build up these little things and you eat them in one or two bites. And we started as I say, a normal restaurant. We started with the a la carte,
yes,
start, a main course dessert, and it took us 12 years to get to this point. And it is just a way of trying to bring people on a little journey through time in terms of Irish food. And like, it's an experience,
yeah.
And I think we're €140, so it's not, I don't like the elitism that comes with expensive menus, and I'm very much interested in trying to feed people and to get them educated. So for me, it's like, it's a treat. It's, people come once a year, you know, but it is like going to the theatre or going to the opera. Like, it's something,
yeah,
that you can take away with you.
I love a tasting menu experience. Once you set yourself up for it, don't eat for the day, feet under the table and get nice and comfortable, and you just chat. You don't even have to think, the food just comes. So I'm well in, but I've never heard of 22 courses. I'm fascinated by that.
I think I'm going to stop there. It was 18, and then I was like, oh, we'll just put another two. And see, there's always new ingredients, and I'm going, how do we get that in? I was like, oh, just add another two. And but the experience is getting longer and longer, and like three and a half hours is like, I don't want it to turn into a kind of 5 hour
sleepover.
Yes. So because people as well want, I suppose, also they don't want to be sitting down for a very, very long time either. So I find three goes at a good pace.
Yeah.
And that's I think that's our limit.
And I think the fact that you've gone to 22 courses and you're saying there's so many local beautiful ingredients, so wild food is abundant, you're saying, basically.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it's really, like, I mean, wild garlic is available at the moment, and that's probably the most popular one. And of course, like, if you're going out into the woods and picking wild garlic, be careful, make sure you do your homework, maybe bring it back and ask someone. But it's there, you can pick it sustainably, in the sense of, you usually take about a third. They say you take a third, leave a third for nature, and then a third for the following year.
Good
tip. That's the same with seaweed. You always think in terms of thirds. You take a third for yourself and leave the other two thirds. And like, it's just a wonderful full taste that really captures the season, because wild garlic has a short window of about 6 to 8 weeks, and it transforms in the flowers and the seeds, and like we get different things from it, but it's just a great way to experience. So if you pick some wild garlic and make a little wild garlic pesto, you put it in your fridge, like in 3 months' time you cannot buy wild garlic, and that's what I love about wild food. Like, you pick it and then you use it or you preserve it, but it's part of your larder then, and then if your friends coming over, it's something unique that you can't just pop down to the supermarket and buy.
So that's a great tip. A third, just pick a third, leave a third. Do you go foraging yourself?
I do still. I try and bring the kids, but they're 14 and 11 now, and they just think I'm crazy. I dropped my daughter up to it when she started school, and there was loads of rowan trees, and she said, if you come near this school and take these berries. I said, there's loads of them. No one's taking them. And she's like, you're a crazy man, and if I see you on the school grounds picking berries. So, and she's like, get out of that person's garden. I was like, there's just some flowers that they don't, they're wild.
I think you're amazing.
We don't, because nasturtiums as well, nasturtiums are a great plant, and people grow them for ornamental, but you can eat the leaf, the pepper, and the flower. That's really peppery. And sometimes, like, when I see a massive one and it's kind of on the outside of someone's garden, I was like, we'll just pick a few flowers. And she was like, oh my god, you're so embarrassing.
So that's a particularly easy one to pick. What else is easy to pick when you go foraging for people?
The elderflower is going to come up soon, and that's really, really distinct, and it just grows on the trees. You can make elderflower lemonade, you can pickle elderflowers. It goes really well with them, with fish. I mentioned the wild garlic. I mean, in the autumn you're going to have blackberries. Everybody knows what a blackberry is. Mm-hmm. You can pick blackberries. Dandelions, even though nobody likes them, there is not there's 300 varieties of dandelions. Wow. And you can eat them all, so you cannot do yourself any harm with a dandelion. I mean, mushrooms are a different ball game, and I'm still very careful with mushrooms because I'm not a mushroom expert, and I know a few, but you always have to be very, very careful with mushrooms. But seaweed, you can knock yourself out.
Yeah.
You get little sea lettuce if you wander down by the beach, and it's really great if people like, I mean, you mentioned running, and I do a bit as well, but if you're going out for a run into nature, like, it's really nice to start to slow down and just to start look, because there are thousands of herbs and plants, and you look at one, you bring it back, you Google and you see what's in season. There's some great websites, Wild Irish Flowers, to help you identify, and then Pranny Radican has a little book on seaweed that you can put in your back pocket and then go down to the beach and just, it's also something you can do with
the kids
as well.
You've just literally triggered a memory. I remember the car on the Sunday drives and my dad pulling over the side of the road because he'd see a blackberry bush. Mm. Everybody out! And we'd all be standing at the side of a road risking death to pick blackberries, and he'd make jam. So we were foraging before we even knew it was called
absolutely.
Foraging.
No, yeah. Absolutely. And it's elderberries are another one. And it's just, look, it's not, foraging is not going to like transform your life into like you're going to be able to just go home and never go to the supermarket again. I'm not that type of forager. I think it's a really great vehicle to just re-engage with your local landscape and to see what, and then when you find a bush, like a blackberry bush or an elderflower tree, and then you can go back to it every year.
JP McMahon talking to Brendan Courtney in the morning. And on the Ray D'Arcy Show, a catch-up with the super vet, Noel Fitzpatrick.
Okay, Noel Fitzpatrick joins us on the line. Beyond Super Vet, How Animals Make Us the Best We Can Be is now available in paperback, the number one Sunday Times bestseller. Good afternoon, Noel.
Good afternoon, Ray. How are you?
Good to talk to you. Now, first question, what song did you play this morning?
That's so funny because I'm actually really tired because I've only had 4 hours sleep. Right. And I needed something to wake me up. So I just played very, very, very loudly some David Bowie, a mixture. And he got me out of bed and got me on my way.
Brilliant. Great choice.
Well, I love a bit of Bowie. And he was such an iconoclastic and an icon and individual. And I really admire that. I admire people who are prepared to make their own space in the world according to their heart. And I think he very much did that.
So you see a bit of yourself in David Bowie.
Oh, at Christmas parties, I have been known to dress up as Ziggy Stardust.
There you go, you see.
But I actually, hilariously, I was in some rock magazine the other day because a friend of mine in a band called You Me at Six came to play our Christmas party, and he said, I've never been... They asked him in Kerrang! Magazine, what's the weirdest gig you've ever played? And he said, Noel Fitzpatrick was dressed up as David Bowie. That's all I need to say. So there you go.
Well, music is a theme throughout the book, and it's a thing. It's a huge part of your life. It soothes you. It gets you up in the morning. It's there in happy times and sad times. So explain its place in your life to me.
This book was lovely for me to write in that sense, because I could mention throughout the narrative journey of the book some songs that I've listened to and that have kind of, as you said, lifted me up when I needed lifting up, and helped me out and soothed me when I needed calming. And the two themes in the book are how animals help me with that. And in fact, my live show was about how medicine is as sexy as music. So I do think that the feelings we feel with music and sometimes with our animal friends lift us to another level, a different plane that it's hard to achieve in real life. So the direct answer to your question is that when I was a kid in Ballyfin, County Leash, Republic of Ireland, I found an old Sony radio on a scrap heap in Mount Mellick in the local town. And I built an aerial out of a coat hanger. And the only station I could get was a pirate radio station called Radio Luxembourg. And the very first song I ever heard in my entire life, other than hymns and the rosary, was Led Zeppelin's Stairway to Heaven. Now, that blew my mind, because I thought, my goodness, this is access to a whole different plane. And since that point, I took it quite literally, of course, that there was a stairway to heaven. And then I fell in love with John Bonham on the drums, and I fell in love with guitar and drums. And since then, through U2 in my teenage years and Jimi Hendrix and all of the greats, The Who and The Rolling Stones and The Beatles, and then right through to the present day. And I just mentioned You, Me at Six and some modern bands that I listen to. What music does for me is it allows me a space which is mine and where I can be myself. And my outlet outside of working here at the practice is to go to gigs. And I'm lucky enough to live near London, so I can do that. And I think it's very important that people give themselves a moment to escape every day and realize what's important to your heart. Whatever kind of music you can listen to can allow you a closer contact, I think, with yourself. And every song that's ever been written is interpreted through your heart and your eyes. So for me, it's really therapeutic.
And things might have been very different for you if back when you were a young lad, instead of offering to buy you a guitar, your dad gave you a saw to cut the horns off a bull.
Yes, you're so right. I had made, because I saw Top of the Pops and I thought, my goodness, this is incredible. And I built a guitar out of a bale of hay and a broom handle and a fertilizer sack. And I threaded the fertilizer sack of 10-10-20, I think it was, underneath the baler twines, and was plucking the twines and twanging off the plastic with the frets on the broom handle as my neck on the guitar. Daddy came around the corner because I was supposed to be stacking hay. And he said to me, "What are you doing?" And I said, "Oh, no, nothing, nothing, nothing." And then later I said to him, you know, could I possibly have one of them mythical things, which, of course, I didn't know the word mythical, but to him it was mythical, a guitar. I may as well have been asking to go to the moon, because he didn't say anything. He handed me a saw and he said, "Sharpen that. We're going to cut the horns off the bullocks tomorrow. There'll be a no twanging around here." And I have that very saw, Ray, on my wall here, right behind me in my office here in Surrey, to remind me of staying humble.
Noel Fitzpatrick on The Ray D'Arcy Show. And on Today with Claire Byrne, from Fermanagh to Formula One, performance engineer Bernie Collins was talking to Claire about her move to Sky Sports.
From growing up in County Fermanagh, where she started her engineering career by dismantling farm machinery, to then going on to work with some of Formula One's biggest teams as an engineer and race strategist, Bernie Collins already has an illustrious CV. But now, Bernie is part of Sky Sports' Formula One coverage this season, and I'm delighted to say that Bernie joins me on the line now. Good morning and welcome, Bernie.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Lovely to talk to you. Will we go right back to dismantling the farm machinery?
Yeah, maybe. So, it's worth pointing out that I didn't, like, my parents didn't actually have a farm, but both of my grandparents did. So yes, there was a lot of that going on.
So what was that? That was your first interest in engineering, was it? Just finding out how things work?
Yeah, I think when I look back, I was always really curious at like how things worked or how they went together, or probably most annoyingly, how they came apart. And I think at the time, maybe I didn't really realise, you know, link that to engineering. But looking back on it now, there was definitely a lot of that going on.
But then as you went through your education, did your love of maths and physics shine through?
Yeah, exactly. So like when you got to the point in school that you're trying to make decisions about subjects or what you enjoy, then yeah, it was definitely all like the math and physics related, or like design and technology. And then I just kept going along those subject lines, so choosing things that I thought, you know, would link into them, which is where the engineering came in when I got to university stage.
Yeah, and I saw that you said that it's sometimes not clear for students as they're going through school that maths and physics can lead you to this career. That's not always obvious, is it?
Yeah, exactly. And I think, like, when I think back to being, you know, 15 or 16 at school, you're making such a huge decision. It seems like such a long way away, you know, your career or what you're doing in the future type thing. So, yeah, I just kept choosing subjects that I enjoyed and hoped that if I kept enjoying the subjects, I would enjoy the work I did at the end.
So how then did motorsport emerge for you as something you were particularly interested in?
So that really, it came quite late. A lot of people, I get like a lot of communication from people that know they want to do motorsport, know they want to work in F1, whatever. But I sort of decided I wanted to do engineering because it was just more math and physics. And then after that, midway through it, we did a thing called Formula Student, where all of the people doing mechanical engineering degrees design a little single-seater race car. And that was the point. And that was like 3 years through my degree that I really started to think that maybe motorsport was an option, or maybe automotive was an option.
Mm-hmm. And you really enjoyed the roles then on the team when you got to get some experience or your trainee work with McLaren, isn't that right?
Yeah, exactly. And I think for me, the motorsport thing was like a good mix of theoretical and hands-on experience. So you weren't just all day at a desk, you know, doing math, or you weren't just all day building stuff. It was like a mix of both. And the McLaren thing gave me a really good opportunity to try loads of different roles within the team as sort of a graduate scheme. So it wasn't just you accepted like a job for life. It was, let's try lots of different jobs and see what you might be suited to.
That must have been like winning the career lottery, was it? Getting access to the McLaren Racing graduate programme.
I think it was one of those really bizarre things where we applied when we were at uni and we were encouraged to apply by our lecturer, which was really great. And then you sort of went along to the various stages of the interview going, well, at least I've got to see around McLaren, or, you know, at least I've got to meet some interesting people, but not really ever believing that you could be there. So, yeah, when you got the call to say that you actually got the position, it was sort of like, wow, this is really happening.
Mm-hmm.
And for a long time when you were going there, it was sort of went with that sort of, this is really bizarre, interesting.
And were you one of the very few women involved in the industry at that level?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's got better and better over the years. But even when I was at uni in my degree, there weren't that many females or girls involved. I think engineering's, you know, was at that time very poor. It's improved year on year. And when you think of the design office at McLaren, yeah, there were very few females. Even when I think, you know, my final role at Aston Martin, when you sit like in the boardroom pre-race and there's sort of 30 of you sat around discussing what's going to happen over the race team, there's sort of like one or two maybe girls in that room. So yeah, it's a poor representation, but they are getting much, much better at it.
Did you feel treated any differently because you were female?
Not really, no. And I think, you know, I don't think I was ever hindered in the opportunities that I was given as a female. I think in many ways, which is potentially controversial view, I think it helped some aspects. When I spoke on the pit wall on the radio as a Northern Irish female, like my voice stood out on the background of male voices. So
yeah,
it was always really clear when I was speaking, it was really clear that, you know, who it came from. So there was definite advantages to it as well.
So Claire asked Bernie about the role of an F1 strategist.
For those of us who are coming anew to what a Formula One strategist and performance engineer is, I read an article that described you with the headphones on and you've got a direct line to the driver mid-race. It all sounds very exciting, but talk us through what you do in that role.
Yeah, so as you know, my final role with Aston was head of race strategy. And that role is all about making decisions through the race in order to get the best finishing position. So for each team, you've got two drivers. You're always looking at decisions for two cars. You're taking in lots of information. So there's lots of information coming from the drivers themselves, from all of the sensors on the car, from various engineers that are concerned with various specifics of the car. So someone might be looking at tyres or whatever. So you're getting lots of information in and you're trying to make a decision about when you do the pit stop and what tyres you fit at that pit stop in order to get the best finishing position. So a lot of like pre-race is planning or doing models in order to decide what you think the quickest race will be. But then in the race, it's a lot of reacting to what's going on around you, a lot of like quick decisions on the pit wall. And yeah, it's really exciting. It's really interesting. There's a lot of pressure, but I think over time you get used to dealing with that.
Mm-hmm. And you you must have to develop a relationship of trust with that driver.
Yeah, with the whole team, really. Like, we do a lot of analysis afterwards because, you know, inevitably some decisions prove to be incorrect at the end of the race. So you go through why you made the decisions and what information you have. And it is like this working relationship very closely with the driver, with the other engineers on the pit wall, such that they, you know, sometimes you make a decision literally seconds before they need to act on it. You're telling them to pit. And they need to trust that that's definitely the right decision in that time and just follow the direction.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, it's a really interesting relationship that you end up with.
But that part of the job, Bernie, when you have the headphones on and you're doing that, that's a very small part of the job, I would imagine, is it?
Yeah, yeah, it is. Yeah, like that's the bit that people see because that's the, like, 2 hours of the race on Sunday or the practice sessions beforehand. But a lot of what makes you good at the job is the prep that you do in advance or the analysis that you do afterwards in order to try and improve. Like, we had a race in 2020 where we actually won the race. It was the only win I've had as a strategist. But a lot of why we won that race was the preparation that we'd done before. And that preparation made the decision that we made during the race really easy because we knew exactly what we should do in that type of situation.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of it is the analysis on a laptop beforehand, trying to understand what you think may happen.
And look, when it comes to climate change, Formula One is in a fairly sticky position here because they're criticised for taking this travelling show all over the world and the emissions that result in that. But then you have the roaring engines, fossil fuel engines. What is happening in the industry and are attitudes changing when it comes to their responsibility around emissions and environmental concerns?
Yeah, I think so. I think when I think of the time that I've been at the tracker in F1, it's come a long way. It's definitely growing in terms of sometimes the people that we have at the track. But they're doing a lot more in terms of just very simple things at the track and reducing waste, recycling more. You know, any of the food that we have left over goes to local communities, those sorts of initiatives that are happening. And I think one of the things with F1 or all motorsport is you can look at it as, you know, a motorsport that doesn't really bring value. But F1 over time has brought a lot of the new developments that we have in all our cars every day. You know, carbon fibre is a big one, a lot of new materials, a lot of new processes that have made our cars more efficient. We've got a lot of the hybrid technology now in order to sort of promote the renewables. But I think one of the things that I'm most excited about personally coming out of F1 is having sustainable fuel, so not fuel that's built with fossil fuels, then potentially you don't have a big swing in what car you have on the road, but you've just dramatically changed the fuel you put into it.
Bernie Collins from Today with Claire Byrne. And that's it for Playback Daily, so mind yourself till next time.